Welcome to the Free Lawyer Podcast. I'm your host, Gary Miles. The Free Lawyer Podcast is designed for the lawyer, entrepreneur, or professional who is in some way unfulfilled, stressed, or stuck, and is looking for something better. We will discuss various blocks that limit us from achieving the personal freedom that we all desire, but have not yet fully experienced. And we will give actionable steps to free yourself from them. Are you looking to achieve a new level of success? If so, this podcast is for you. Hey everybody, welcome to today's episode of The Free Lawyer. And just want to thank each and every one of you for not only listening today, but for all the support you've given the podcast. It's really done fantastic. And I just want to ask a favor of you. If you enjoy what you hear and enjoy the messages you get today, and I know today will be a special one for you, but if you enjoy what you hear, I would love you to give me a rating and review of the podcast, because that helps it get seen by more people. And that's what matters most to me, is that more people hear these messages. And if you don't follow the podcast yet, click the follow button. Then the episodes will be waiting for you every Monday and every Thursday, so you can hear gems like this one. Today, I'm so thrilled to have with us today, Jeff Cunningham. Jeff is not only one of the best litigators in Connecticut, he concentrates in the area of malpractice, insurance defense, but more than that, he's a fractional general counsel to lawyers like you and me, who helps us solve our problems before they happen, to help prevent those claims that none of us want to go through. Jeff, how are you today?
Doing great. Thanks so much for having me back. And thank you from the bottom of my heart for the podcast. I think, and your message, I think it really is such a service to the profession, such a needed service. So thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. I really appreciate that. So Jeff, let's begin by just telling the audience a little bit about what you do now.
So my focus is on representing lawyers and law firms, typically small, 10 lawyers or less, although I have a few clients that are larger firms, in legal malpractice and attorney discipline, you know, sort of traditional defense roles, but also as fractional general counsel. So representing the firms before there's problems, acting as a privileged communication conduit, and using my experience to sort of get them the most return on investment from a risk management standpoint.
Jeff, I know you're kind of in a different role now, acting as a general counsel for law firms. And your focus, as I understand, is to manage their risk and to be proactive and stop claims before they happen. Tell me how that proactive approach differs from that of a malpractice defense lawyer, and how you benefit your firms by doing that.
Yeah, I started as a malpractice defense lawyer. It's still a large part of my practice, and you know, I think that's completely responsive. You know, you get the lawsuit, you respond to it. Maybe you get something pre-suit and you try to settle it before it actually goes to court, although that's pretty rare. And now as the outside GC for law firms, it really, we sort of look at their client base. We look at their different practice areas. You know, we look at the available statistics and risk management, you know, sort of objective risk management approaches for smaller law firms, and say, okay, here's where our problem areas probably are. What can we do today to make sure those don't blow up, or at least as close to making sure as we can? You obviously can't mitigate all the risk.
Gotcha. And what are the components, what are the essential attributes of your approach, of your proactive approach?
So I think the biggest key to my approach, and it's not rocket science by any stretch, is the simplicity. You know, you can come up with a perfect system for, say, conflicts, an absolutely perfect system. It would 100% of the time catch your conflicts. But if no one's going to use it because it's too complicated, or if no one's going to use it because it's too onerous and you can't bring in any clients, so you can't bring in any money, then that's not as good as the system that only catches half the conflicts out there. And so I think using simple systems that actually do work, but that your team, your people will actually employ, I think that's the key. And just trying to keep everything as simple as possible. And really, all it is breaking it down into smaller parts. So I want 100% conflict system. But if you look at it as five different systems that are nice and easy to use, you're much more likely to get the buy-in from your people to actually use it.
It is important to eliminate human error, and that's always not so easy, is it?
Right. That's definitely the weakest link.
What are some key strategies or practices that law firms can implement to proactively address some of these situations before they occur?
Yeah, so I think, you know, looking, it's very practice specific and firm size specific, looking at what your big risks are. But the big risks across the board to law firms, you know, 500 lawyers, solo practitioners, all different sorts, you know, criminal defense, the transactional to litigation, client communication. There's just not enough of it. You know, we hear it all the time that lawyers just need to pick up their phone. I am a big fan of a simple system where you check in with your client once a week or once a month or whatever is appropriate, regardless of whether something's happening or not. And every communication is followed up in writing. The more touch points you can have with your client to let your client know that you're thinking about them, even if nothing's happening, maybe it's more important when nothing's happening in the case, the better you're going to be. And client satisfaction is directly tied to law firm risk. The other huge area that you know, I know you are very tapped into, but I think most law firms don't acknowledge or don't realize is attorney wellness. Per the ABA, 55% of all legal malclaims and all attorney discipline involve attorney wellness, either mental health or substance abuse. And those are self-reported numbers. In my experience, that number is like closer to 99%. If it's a substantive claim, you know, anyone can make a grievance. Any client can sue for malpractice. So if you scrape aside the bogus ones, the frivolous ones, if there's any substance at all, it almost always comes back to attorney wellness in some capacity.
So 99% has to be an exaggeration, or at least close to it. But really, the overwhelming majority of the malpractice claims and grievances you see arise out of attorney wellness.
Definitely, definitely. And you know, 99% is an exaggeration, but I think it's more accurate than the 55% of self-reported. You know, I think it's closer to 99%.
And how do you, as the attorney for that attorney who's afflicted with either addiction or severe clinical depression, how do you manage that relationship to properly represent them? Because that same person who arguably committed malpractice or some ethical obligation violation is your client and still mm-hmm. struggling with those same things.
Yeah. And you know, it's, as you know, it's extremely challenging from a professional standpoint and the personal toll that the individual suffering from whatever the issue is, you know, can't be overstated. I think, again, from my standpoint, it's all about simplicity. So a very simple thing I try to do with small law firms is getting two signatures required on a client fund account. So if you have an attorney trust account, get two signatures required on there. Figure it out now before someone needs money for gambling, for a divorce, for a substance abuse habit, whatever the issue is. I mean, that's a huge source of risk. And, you know, oftentimes I see two or three partners start a law firm and they trust one another. And that's wonderful. You shouldn't go into business with someone you don't trust. But you never know what someone else is going through. And there's just, you know, no need to allow the temptation, especially at the outset. When everyone's doing good, when everybody's getting along, get two signatures on there. Build those simple systems in early to really remove the potential for 5 years down the road if a problem develops. If a problem's already developed, obviously that's trickier. And I think, you know, I bring privileged communications, which is huge. But I think the biggest thing I can do is be sort of an objective outsider outside the firm, outside the politics. You know, two lawyers and you have politics, 200 lawyers, you have crazy politics. Be an outsider to say, hey, we need to bring in some professionals here who can address, you know, again, whatever the wellness situation is.
I want to emphasize what you said. I don't know what the percentages are, but I know they were quite high in the ABA study. They were about 30% of lawyers suffered from addiction and about the same number from clinical depression. And that's pretty astonishing. You know, if mm-hmm. you have a firm of 100 lawyers, that's 30 who may struggle with addiction. And it is a topic worthy of discussion. And many of you know, and I've shared before, I'm sober in recovery and been sober for 32 years and chaired the Lawyer Assistance Committee in my area in Maryland for 20. And every state has something like the Lawyer mm-hmm. Assistance Committee, and they're there to help. It's confidential. They provide support depending on the state. They may provide therapy. They may help you if you have financial needs to get into a recovery facility. They may help support your practice with some lawyer who may volunteer to help you if you're away in a recovery center. But trust me, if you're struggling at all with any kind of addiction, you're not the only one. I went through it. A lot of people have, and there are many, many people willing to help because your law practice, your career is too important to take that chance.
And those bar association systems, you know, I think they're wonderful because they're lawyers, right? So they really understand the stress and the challenges that attorneys are facing. I mean, so not only do they understand the wellness component, but they understand the professional component too. And I think it really works well. I mean, and it's such a valuable resource.
Yeah, our lawyer assistance committee was composed of only attorneys and mostly attorneys who had experience with addiction and recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And we also had two trained experts who were on the staff of the Maryland State Bar Association. I suspect most bar associations likewise, who are truly experts in recovery or managing mental health issues. So it's really worthwhile to seek help if you're struggling, because the percentages are really daunting. I want to get back to what you
going. Self-reported. You know, the ABA uses self-reported statistics, and they're terrible. So the actual statistics have to be way worse. I mean, it really is just
right. I remember that the one self-reported statistic was something like 11.9% of the attorneys had suicidal thoughts in the prior year.
Right. Yeah.
If I had suicidal thoughts last year, I wouldn't tell the ABA.
Right.
So
you right.
wonder what the percentage might be, but that's a very scary statistic. And I hear in my conversations with lawyers, too many stories of lawyers and their locales who committed suicide. And it's something we even cringe to think about, much less talk about. But if you're struggling, please reach out for help, because help is there. I want to get back to what you said about communication, to think that is one of the major causes of client dissatisfaction, and it's so easy. I handle all the intake of new calls for my law firm, of which I'm now of counsel to. And that's a complaint I hear the most in family law. My attorney won't talk to me. And it seems to me, Jeff, it's a win-win. I get paid to answer my client's questions.
Right.
My client wants me to answer their questions. If I answer their questions, they get happy. I get more fees. Everyone should be happy. So I've never quite understood why lawyers don't do that. They may be too busy, but then the solution is you get more help, you leverage mm-hmm. help, and farm some of your cases out to your associate and pay good attention to your clients. But I know I've seen that as well, that's a big problem.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in the defense bar, where you're billing for every single call to your client, every single email to your client, you're billing, you're getting paid for that. And it remains the number one complaint about attorneys on the defense side as well. And, you know, I think it really does come down to just case management and not having the support to be able to appropriately communicate with the clients. And it's a low priority, especially if nothing's happening that week. You know, do you have time to call the client? Do you want to charge the client? No. So you just let it slide. But then a month goes by, 2 months go by, and the client gets upset. I think it's a great way for firms to, you know, take a litmus test to make sure things are working well. If you have clients that are complaining about getting, you know, in touch with their lawyers, you got a problem. You got to figure out what it is. You know, it may be they're too busy. It may be a bad lawyer. It may be someone struggling. I mean, you know, there's a whole host of potential causes, and it may be more than one. But, you know, if you're having communications problems, they're not going to get better. They're only going to get worse.
So how does one, when you have a client where you think that's an issue, how do you, as fractional general counsel to that firm, change that pattern?
So I think there's really two easy steps. I think it's super simple, is just require a check-in, either once a week, once a month. I think anything beyond once a month, you're sort of leaving it up to the, you know, whatever you were doing before, right? It becomes sort of a periodic check-in. And at that point, when lawyers decide, oh yeah, I need to update the client, they're usually doing it at the point that they really genuinely need to update the client. But the client, you know, getting an email once a week that says status quo, waiting on that decision from the court, waiting on, you know, the other side to send the papers back to us, whatever the issue is, you know, that touch point lets the client know you're there, right? You're on top of it. They don't need to come to you. And I think anything you can do to stop the client from having to pick up the phone and call you and sort of be the one driving the bus, I think that just makes them feel like they're in good hands, which they more often than not they are. So I think setting triggers, you know, periodic by time, whatever time's appropriate for your practice and your clients, and then also by milestone. And that's sort of the biggest thing is, you know, if a decision comes in, if a settlement demand comes in, if a transactional papers come in and they're not timely reported on, that's a huge problem. And you know, that's one that's probably only going to get worse. So having those two triggers, systems to send out communications at those points, I think is really the best approach. And it's very easy once it gets going.
Jeff, you have defended malpractice cases for your career. Now you're switching into this more proactive approach, in addition to continuing to do your defense work. What caused you to do that? And why do you find that more fulfilling?
So, you know, it is, and it's something, you mentioned it, how the suicide rates, and I had a client who had a personal tragedy because of pressures from their professional life, and it really shook me. I didn't appreciate how damaged our profession was. And you know, I had been working. I would get a file, I'd get a legal malclaim, I'd defend it, we'd get another one, I'd defend it. This client's personal story made me look at my profession and say, you know, why am I waiting until disaster has struck to pick up the pieces when I could take what I've learned and just sort of offer that to clients before the disaster strikes. Now, you can't always stop the disaster, but you can certainly make it better. You can plan and prepare for it as best you can. And I think because wellness is really so tied to it, it allows you to sort of set a safety net. Right. I mean, you know, wellness is going to be a factor when things go wrong. So if people are vulnerable in one way or the other, you can, again, kind of plan for that and have the bar resources ready to go, have that relationship already there in place.
You mentioned the attorney client privilege. What are the benefits of using an outside general counsel such as yourself with attorney client privilege? And what do your clients do to preserve that privilege? I'm thinking by contrast, if I talk to my partner about, oh, this son of a gun, they filed this malpractice, this is bogus, and I put an email and he responds in emails, they're all discoverable, aren't they?
Right. I mean, you could fight it. It would depend. But having outside general counsel is definitely the cleanest way to preserve the privilege. If you had in-house, you know, if you had one of your partners designated as your firm's general counsel, and it was pretty clear that the communication was referencing that litigation, that claim, or even pre-litigation, then you have a good chance of, you know, asserting the privilege and protecting the discovery there, although you probably will have to produce a privilege log. The problem isn't so much when a couple of partners are talking about defending the firm. The problem is when the problem happens and you have an associate emailing a paralegal back and forth, and then some other associate who's not involved, you know, is asked about it, or then it starts to go up the chain. The partner starts emailing with the paralegals and the associates, and then they tell firm leadership, whoever they decide is the person they should go to. And inevitably along that chain of a mess, now that may or may not be privileged, but inevitably somebody bills the client. And as soon as someone charges the client for that email mess, trying to fix the problem, sort out the problem, then that communication belongs to the client. So it's not privileged. And that's a losing fight. So outside general counsel allows just super clean, this is privileged. The only reason the firm talks to me is for privileged communications. The other thing it does, and I think it really does well, is it allows me to be like an ombudsman for the firm. If associates especially, but associates and staff know that I'm there and they can talk to me on behalf of the firm. Now, obviously I represent the firm. At some point I have to go to firm leadership and firm ownership. But I'm an avenue that's not the managing partner. That's not their direct boss. And I think it really does provide a healthy channel for them to communicate with me. I even have some clients who, in the firm's best interest, you know, don't want me to reveal confidences about wellness, so that their people can go to me and say, "Hey, I have a gambling problem, and it's becoming an issue. What do I do?" And I can deal with firm management without identifying the person or you know, throwing them under the bus while we solve the problem for the benefit of the firm.
Yeah, that's so important. I know that for many lawyers, one of the reasons that's given for not dealing with their problems is how they'll be viewed, how they'll be criticized, how they'll be judged because they're struggling. And and that can really thwart someone's efforts to get sober, stop a gambling problem, deal with their depression. But yet it's so important. I think firms are becoming a little more enlightened about not mistreating anyone who's struggling with some mental health condition, just like we wouldn't mistreat someone who's dealing with a physical health condition.
Exactly. Yep. I think we are coming around. I think given the legal profession's, you know, glacial movement in other areas, I think we're coming around rather quickly. And I think that's a testament to the size of the problem, right? I don't think any lawyer, I think we see those statistics about, you know, wellness and the depression, anxiety, the suicidal ideation, things like that. I don't think anyone's surprised. They're shocking statistics, right? They're terrible statistics. But I don't think anybody's like, nah, that can't be true. You know, like most lawyers are like, yeah, that makes sense. That's probably low. And, you know, that's a problem.
That's sad, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's brutal.
One of the things I've seen you talk about is response planning. What is response planning and how can law firms use it?
Yeah. So, you know, it's again, simplicity is the absolute key. But I had a law firm client that had a cyber breach. I was their GC. And, you know, we brought in cyber counsel, their carrier and all that stuff. And the cyber counsel explained that the first 4 hours, you know, the 24 hours is like absolutely key, but the first 4 hours is kind of make or break in the cyber breach world. And I thought about it, and that's really true for anything. You don't want to spend that first 4 hours or that first 24 hours if you get a grievance or if, you know, if one of your people tells you they have a substance abuse problem or if there's a criminal issue or tax issue, whatever the issue is. You should have, you know, it doesn't have to be a complicated plan, but you should have a plan including contacts. You know, you should have a criminal defense lawyer that you should be able to contact that sort of knows your firm. You don't have to have them retained. If you can, that's wonderful. But you should have someone who could handle a tax issue if it came up today, you know. And I think that's something that law firms tend not to have. And you waste a day or two asking all your friends, you know, hey, does anybody know a tax guy? Does anybody know a cyber guy? You shouldn't have to look for your insurer's contact information. You should have that readily available. You break glass, you take out your plan for your cyber response, and you hit the ground running. And I think one of the great things that outside GC does, again, that an internal GC might not have the bandwidth to do, is I sort of bring the response plans and say, hey, you know, do you guys have a response plan for an attorney wellness situation? And inevitably, they don't. No. I say, well, here's a template. Let's start filling it out. You know, who do you call first? How do you secure files? How do you secure money? You know, let's who in your bar association, you know, is the key for this resource with the confidentiality to attach?
You know, that makes so much sense. My wife is a director of nursing and they have all sorts of disaster plans.
Exactly.
That happens in their facility, you know, a flood, yep. Fire, whatever it might be. COVID, yep. Outbreak. But, you know, I managed my firm for 30 years. I didn't have any such thing. And I mean, I knew about wellness and if it came up, I'd deal with it. But the thought of actually planning ahead and having the name of the lawyer we call if there's a problem of this nature or the resource we'd reach out to makes so much sense because then we could just pull out our binder and say, what's the best way to deal with this? Oh, we've already figured that out. That makes so much sense.
And, you know, I've found... Say you're planning your tax response plan, right? And everything's been great with your taxes, but you're including your CPA, you're finding tax counsel you might need one day. Inevitably, you have a call with that tax guy. He does conflicts. You give him a retainer if you want, or you just have him on speed dial if you need, but you're going to have a conversation with him. He's going to tell you, you know, you're going to tell him about your practice, your firm. He's going to tell you the big areas of concern that he always has. And you're going to learn so much just from creating that communication. And then look, he's going to refer stuff to you. You're going to be able to refer stuff to him. It's just win-win across the board. And then God forbid a tax issue explodes, you're ready to go, you know, or as ready as you can be.
What do you think from the different law firms and clients you've had is the biggest problem that lawyers are facing today?
So, you know, it's tempting to say ChatGPT and AI, but it's not really ChatGPT and AI. And it's not even tech. I think the evolution of tech for me, is highlighting the problem. And for me, it comes back to wellness. We've seen, you know, in the Southern District of New York, where I practice, we've had several now instances of, you know, we had the Avianca versus Mata case, where attorneys filed briefs with AI-generated case law that didn't exist, and they got sanctioned pretty heavily. Michael Cohen of Donald Trump fame, you know, his lawyers took AI-generated case law from him and submitted it to the court. They actually didn't get sanctioned. I was shocked. They got embarrassed, but they didn't get sanctioned. And then there was a law firm in New York that just used ChatGPT to support a fee claim, and the court really came down heavily on them for attempting to do it. I thought they did it really well, but the judge did not. And I think, you know, what I see AI highlighting is not that lawyers are bad with tech, because okay, fine, lawyers are bad with tech, but not that the computers are going to take over and replace us. But really, why are these lawyers misusing AI? Because they're overwhelmed, they're overburdened, and they're trying to find efficient ways to represent their clients. And I think it goes back to wellness. It really does. I think that's our biggest challenge. And I think it's connected, whether you're talking about client communication, whether you're talking about knowing the law substantively, conflicts, financial stuff. Wellness is there. It's the common denominator in every single problem.
And, you know, I've done a lot of podcasts with it. My most recent one, I talked about what bar associations and the profession can do. But how can we start really addressing that problem of wellness? What suggestions do you have, Jeff?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, the Bar Association is great, and obviously friends and family are great. I think that law firms are really uniquely placed. You deal with your partners, you deal with your staff and your associates, probably more than you do your family, unfortunately. You know, I work remotely most of the time, I still spend a ton of time with my colleagues, and it's great. But that gives you, I think, you being any lawyer, any law firm employee, it doesn't have to be a lawyer, that gives you a window into people's, you know, struggles in a way that, you know, their siblings or their cousins or their parents, you know, may not. Maybe their spouse knows, maybe their spouse doesn't know. But it really lets you be there for people, and also to remember that these people are there for you too, right? Because we're all struggling with stuff. And so I think for law firms to really say, hey, this is actually a real resource. You know, if we can create an atmosphere where people can safely share their struggles before there's a problem, you know, we can get ahead of this. And we can really, I mean, it makes a better team. I think it makes better lawyers, you know, better non-lawyer support staff. But it really is a great risk management tool too. So I think while the bar associations are doing what they're doing, I think law schools are doing a great job doing what they're doing. I think society as a whole is sort of moving around on this issue. I think getting more law firms to understand that they're in a wonderful place to take this real challenge of wellness and turn it into a resource. I think that's the most important conversation I can have with a lawyer.
Well, I think if we have a partner who we believe to be struggling, it's incumbent upon us to try to take that step. And it requires a step of courage, because it's hard to approach someone who may be a friend, maybe a partner, and say, I think we have an issue here.
Yeah.
But it is worthwhile. I've had occasion to do that both professionally and personally during my career. And I think it's been very important. And sometimes it's not well received. I mean, sometimes people are struggling with addiction. When someone says, I think you have a problem, they don't go, oh, I sure do. Thank you so much. They can get angry. But it's still a worthwhile step to try. And if not, there are resources outside the firm that can be of assistance.
And I think, you know, that's one area as outside general counsel, I probably don't get the chance to do it enough, but I think it's one area I have done. And I think it can be effective. Again, you know, someone can get angry at me. I'm talking on behalf of the firm. So I'm not saying, hey, Jim thinks you have a problem. I'm saying the firm is concerned. But also, you know, that outside objectiveness, I'm still an attorney, so I still have that connection with the lawyer who's struggling. And then while I'm not, you know, I'm not the best resource when it comes to actually dealing with the wellness issues, I can kind of hold that person's hand. And if they're receptive, I can get them to the professional that can really actually help them and address the issue. But I do understand the legal issues, the ethics issues, and the work. And I think that helps. And I'm not their partner. You know, I'm not someone they see every day.
I think it's a huge advantage to have someone like you raising the question on behalf of the firm, instead of one partner saying to the other partner, I think you have a problem. That's a real advantage.
It makes it professional, not personal. Yeah.
Right. professional. Tell me, Jeff, what do you find most fulfilling about what you do as a fractional general counsel?
So, you know, we were talking just before we hit record. And for me, it's the most fulfilling thing has been moving to a flat fee model. I have a membership, a monthly membership for small firms, which has been wonderful. And I've learned more. I've done it since February of last year. I've learned more about my clients' families, their kids, the sports that they like, you know, their hobbies. I've learned more about that in the year I've been doing this membership than in 15 years of charging clients hourly. And no one tells me about their children when they're paying me for it. They hang up the phone before we ever get to anywhere near that conversation. You know, I know my clients' birthdays now. I mean, it's been so wonderful. Fulfilling to actually connect with people. And it's made for much more work. And it's been, you know, financially, it's been way better. But it's really been eye-opening to see how getting the chance to connect is just people, really, really how impactful that can be.
That model is really a win-win because your clients don't mind talking to you because they know they're not going to get billed for 3/10 of an hour or whatever hourly rate. Right. They're building a relationship and a connection. And it's helpful for you as a lawyer for the firm to have that connection with your clients because you can better advise them, guide them, and support them. You know, Jeff, I call this podcast The Free Lawyer because someone asked me, why do you call it The Free Lawyer? It's not about giving our services away for nothing, but it's about how we can find personal freedom as a lawyer. What does personal freedom mean to you, Jeff?
So, I mean, yeah, this is a great question you always pose on the podcast, in your content, and I love it. And it was something I honestly had never thought about before getting involved with and meeting you through LinkedIn. I think for me, obviously, there's a component of financial security for my family. But I think it's getting to do what I want to do professionally. That really is it's something that's been really wonderful this past year to sort of pick where I feel like I can help, where my value comes out, and I can kind of make a difference. And it's really been is wonderful. I used to approach the job as a job in a way that I just don't anymore. And I haven't had to since really shifting the focus of my practice. And I think the more outside GC work I can get, the more flat fee work I can get, the more I'll be able to do that and the freer I'm going to feel. And I am working on your book, and I can't wait to I've only just started it, and I've already got some golden nuggets. And I'm sure after completing it, I'll have a nice roadmap to how I'm going to get there. And I appreciate that.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you very much. You know, I did insurance defense for quite a while too, and I loved it. But one of the issues for me was it wasn't quite that fulfilling because the solving the problem, winning the case, getting it settled was sort of abstract to me. Mm-hmm. When I went into family law, I was really helping people and really building a connection with them and really answering the problems. I felt more fulfilled. And I could see what you do now. You have a real relationship with your clients and you're solving their problems before they happen and therefore making their practice more secure. You feel rewarded and fulfilled by doing that.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Jeff, thank you so much for all your insights today. I'm sure there'll be a bunch of folks who might want to reach out to you and learn about how you can help them as lawyers and law firms. What's the best way for them to get in touch with you, Jeff?
Probably on LinkedIn. I mean, I'm there all the time, as you know, and I you know, I'm readily accessible, just Jeff Cunningham on LinkedIn. I also go by The Law Firm GC on pretty much, I think, every other social media platform. So, but that's really the best way.
And for those of you who haven't spoken to Jeff yet, he's a fantastic guy and a great lawyer. And, you know, it's so crazy. I've been in this profession for 45 years, and we're great at being lawyers for other people, but not so great about watching out for our own needs. It's sort of bizarre. And you're entitled to get that advice. And it's such a small expenditure in comparison to the huge benefit you can get. And Jeff is really the best there is. So I encourage you to reach out to Jeff, set up a call with him, see if he can be of service to you and your firm. You'll be really happy you did.
Thanks so much.
And Jeff, thank you for being here with me today. And thanks to all of you for listening. I appreciate each and every one of you. And as always, please be well, be safe, and be free. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Free Lawyer Podcast. Wherever you are listening, if you enjoyed what I shared, please leave me a rating and review. I would appreciate hearing more about what you like best, and what topics you might like me to cover in future episodes. If you are interested in experiencing a more fulfilling and a more successful life, please contact me at www.garymiles.net, where you can schedule a free discovery call with me so I can learn more about you, your challenges, and your dreams. I appreciate each and every one of you, and have a great rest of your day. Thanks to all of you for your support.